Okay, we're continuing our conversation with Derek DeKirchhoff. Carry on, Derek. Prospect, what is it you want to begin with today?
Well, it's still good old Barry, who really is very bright, I have to say.
This article, these quotes are impressing you.
They make you think perceptually, and that's pretty cool. And so here goes. My first perception, however, is the voice of this woman who says, "That's like a school mom, you know. You're now connected, or please insert your pin." I think she really wants to punish us. Anyway, that being said, the way he looks at how to identify various changes, the weak signals of the future kind of thing, is very good. And he discusses something that I'd like some kind of reflection upon, the whole idea of the relation between cause and effect, which was a big deal for McLuhan, and who quoted all the time, causae et causa sine vicensunt.
Yeah.
Of Cicero, but the effects preceding the cause, we need to amplify on that. We need to work on it in such a way that we can give good example of it, and at the same time show how the configuration of such collaboration between past, present, and future actually occurs.
Yes,
I find it very interesting, because all times are now is one of the things Marshall said.
Yes,
and it's a very important observation. But then he didn't get into the mechanics of how time is unfolding in our mind, or how we are, creating its variations.
Let me give you an anecdote. We say them as they come up. All times now, when Marshall died in the last day of 1980, within a few weeks, Hugh Kenner wrote a remembrance for National Review, and he said, one time they were driving around with Marshall's mother. Now, this would be the late 40s. And his mother was complaining. She didn't understand the cantos and pound and what was that about. And Kenner says, Marshall said, it's expressing that all times are now. So that's what he told his mother back in the 40s.
Isn't that fabulous?
Yeah. And Kenner has that. He writes that out in his article.
That's excellent. Well, you trust you. It's very good. I'm very glad because you said that, because it does put together the cantos. And
and Finney's way.
But it also McLuhan's thinking. That's fabulous.
That he could say that way back then, you know.
Yeah. That's astounding.
So you were saying prospect or the relation
we
of time?
We go into the in-prospect part, and let me just read the first line. Instead of projecting past figures to future fantasies, learning to recognize the process patterns of the present ground actually shaping the things to come by. And he then starts with instant preplay.
Yeah, that's the tetrad. He's going to make a tetrad, not an instant replay, but an instant preplay.
Yeah, and what is interesting is that, of course, it plays right into Baudrillard's simulacre, everything to do with simulation probing by pre-playing. I mean, that's really what it is. And I thought, okay, it's interesting because at that time we were not talking a lot about simulation. Yeah, there were flight simulators, there was this and that. It would take an electric engineer to actually think through that and go from the flight simulator to the idea.
Hey, listen, another story. Remember, he's talking in the late 60s of programming the global theater. That was his accepting of virtual reality and simulation. And then,
But that was Marshall. That wasn't Barry.
No. Yeah, that was Marshall. And but Barry was there. He's there from '65 on, and he writes an article in '68 for the later explorations, and he goes into some of this. But
that's funny. What are you saying, that Barry was there all the time? That I was there? No.
Oh yeah. He started in '65.
He must have had an eclipse at some point, because I certainly don't remember starting with Barry. Barry was nowhere to be seen until 1971, when I was, 90.
Okay, so he's there. He's writing for the Due Line and
right, he is writing for the Due Line. I do remember that.
Right, in 68. And he's working on Take Today from 68 till it comes out in 72. He may have had a job, or he was busy on the book, and you didn't see that. You know, you didn't see him. He wasn't around the student world. By 71, that makes sense. You know, the book's coming out in 72, so you see him there in 71. But no, he was there And that's what's odd, that your panel at the MEA last week included Barry as part of the 1953 gang, but he wasn't there in 53. But people consider him part of that early circle. But what was the other point about, but why did we bring up, okay, so Barry, programming the environment, and in 1977, maybe you attended this at Convocation Hall, I think, of the University of Toronto campus. I remember this. Tom Wolfe came to speak. And
yes.
Barbara Frum introduced him. Do you remember that night?
Yes.
And
yes.
Marshall's sitting up on the side laughing all the time that Wolf is talking.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was that was one of the first times I heard the word simulation. Wolf was criticizing, you know, literary people or whatever. They weren't looking at simulation. And he pointed that out.
Wolf was the first guy to blurt it out. Good.
Yeah, for me, it was the first time I heard the word. And, you know, Baudrillard was maybe talking about it within the year or two. But
well, Baudrillard had written about it and also wrote a book which had a title, L'échange symbolique et la mort. No, there was Simulacre. Simulacre in French is simulation, but it actually has a negative connotation.
But that's 77. That comes out about 77, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have that in my eyes for the moment.
Well, when the book comes out under Semitex in 83, it's a reprint of something he did in the late 70s. I know that.
I see. Okay.
So, yeah, so he was doing – so Tom Wolfe was – maybe he was looking – maybe when he did the right stuff and was looking into NASA and the history of NASA, that's where he got the simulation idea, because they were doing it at NASA.
Of course they were. They had to.
Yeah, so that's maybe why he caught on it early. But I always remember McLuhan – he was not impressed with Barbara Frum. He may have laughed during her intro, but he was being really rude. And it was quite obvious. Remember, he sat up on the side while we were all down on the front of the stage, and he's there totally visible to everybody on the side, up above a bit.
Mm-hmm. No, I remember that. Yes, it was. He maltreated her very, very nicely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And I think she sat on the stage the whole time with a puzzled look on her face. That's what I recall. Like, she was out of her element. But that's an information processor, what Coker would call. She's an android processor. She just processed data, you know, and had very involved, right? Very, very
it's
involved.
It's fun that you remind me of Barbara Frum. I had forgotten her, but now I was once in the powder room with her. I mean, not the powder room.
The green room.
The makeup room, yeah.
Yeah?
We were both in some show. Oh, yes! Wait a minute. I think it was the show right after Marshall died, because I was brought on television literally a day or two after Marshall died to comment on him, and they were already starting... There was this guy who was already starting to mean-mouth him. I was...
Michael.
I was,
Michael somebody. He wrote...
Bliss.
The
Michael
National...
Bliss?
Yes, wasn't it
Michael
him?
Bliss, yeah. He actually said... that Marshall was very overvalued. He didn't say that in those words, but his example was, well, you know, he only had 7 PhD theses to his name. I mean, by that, he had only, you know, as a professor, he wasn't all that great.
He didn't have
not
many
being
PhD
able,
students, right.
That's right. And so then I just lashed in and I said, well, how many theses, do you have, or something like this? Or I just didn't even think. I was just curious. And Barbara Frum said, "Now, no personal comment, Eric." You know, that was really fun. And Bliss,
now, would that
course,
have been a morning, or as it happens, or a morning thing?
I can't remember.
Oh no, it was TV.
Really...
You say it was TV?
Oh yeah, it was TV.
Oh, okay,
for sure.
I don't know what show that would be, but I wasn't watching TV, CBC too much. As it happens,
no,
was very popular at the time. Everybody listened to that.
Okay,
so and Bliss shows up. I know him because he shows up every time. He was the designated neoconservative guy to just destroy McLuhan's memory, of the memory of McLuhan. Yes, and he was the man. And he wrote articles for whatever, McLean's or something. Whenever Marsh showed up, they brought in Mr. Bliss to shoot him down. So how did it turn out? Do you recall... was it a standoff with Bliss? What's your feeling after?
No. I think my argument actually won. I think it was absolutely clear that none of these. I said, how many of these students are internationally known?
Yeah, right.
How many of these? Really? How can you say that? There was a lot. There was. I don't know.
And
he was clear. I mean, the guy just couldn't stand anybody else uphanding him or
that's right.
Whatever.
And there, if someone played those recordings, they're fools now. Those people objected
fools.
To Marshall.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they are complete fools. As in France, you never hear a peep anymore against Marshall in France. It's very interesting.
But everybody came out. Everybody came out swinging in the 70s against Marshall.
Absolutely, absolutely. Even Baudrillard mean mouthed him, and certainly Lacan had no time for him, and certainly Foucault had no time for him.
And the later guys, Levy and Bourdieu, and all those newer names, Bruno Latour, you know, those people.
Yeah, Latour. No, Latour actually is quite a gentleman, I have to say. I've met him personally, and I have been surprised and impressed by his elegance of mind and his quality of thought. This is an interesting man.
Does he mention McLuhan?
I knew. Sorry.
Does he mention McLuhan, Latour?
Latour.
Bruno Latour.
Does does he in his books? Yes, I think once or twice Marshall is in there. I think so.
Right.
And he has expanded on McLuhan without being part of the McLuhan. I wouldn't make him anywhere close to the Toronto School of Communication. Of course not. I don't think I would put any of the French. The only one I would. Because of having been the only person who actually understood the importance of McLuhan and taught it to his students and got Bourdieu, among others, Bourdin, among others, into that, it's Jean Duvigneau. Duvigneau is somebody who actually invited McLuhan to France in university, made him, invited him to his university, all kinds of stuff that happened, and included me into the fact I was becoming the kind of the go-between Jean Duvigneau and Marshall McLuhan.
How do you spell Duvigneau? I don't know that name.
Duvigneau is Duvignaud.
Oh, I've seen that name. Your pronunciation is it. Yes, definitely I've seen that name. No,
all right, so Jean was my thesis director for a PhD thesis in France, which I did on the Greek tragedy.
Yes.
And Jean, I will never forget going with Jean and Marshall to see Ionesco.
That's what I was going to say. This is talked about in Marshall's biography. That's you were there at the Ionesco McLuhan meeting, right? That's what you're saying.
I was. I mean, I was one of who arranged it.
Right.
And so I asked for it, and it happened. But what happened was that we were up going the elevator. You know the story of the elevator?
I think that's in the book. Sounds familiar, but go ahead.
We don't need to talk about it.
I can't remember. No, I never heard of it, Derek.
Very funny.
Go.
Because, no. So here we are in a French elevator, and it's all... grillage, so it's all you see through everywhere. So it has an elegant staircase, reasonably large, surrounding it. It seems as if the building had actually, an old early 19th century building, which would have thought about elevators already, so making room for one. Anyway, so this elevator is now clear, and it stops at between two floors at the third floor when we were supposed to get to the fifth, and we can't get out. And so we're calling, and nobody's coming. And eventually, Ionesco himself comes out of his apartment, sees the predicament, and starts running around us, up and down those stairs. This little man who looked like a clown. He was a great guy, but he looked like a clown. He was running around this, saying, "Ne vous inquiétez pas, on va tout s'occuper." I thought we were in one of his plays. It was very funny. So anyway, we got out.
How did you get out?
Well, eventually some mechanic came and fixed the problem, but I can't remember exactly because I was so totally fascinated by Ionesco and by our conversation in there, which was so exciting.
What's the meaning of
that?
What's the metaphoric meaning? Here's the absurdist theater writer is seeing McLuhan trapped in suspended animation. What could that be, you know? And he's feeling responsible for it.
Well, I'm sure that the thought must have crossed the mind of Ionesco for sure.
Yeah.
And that evening we went to see the opening of a play all together. It was called Macbeth, B-E-T-T-E.
Yeah.
E-T-T-E. And so instead of B-E-T-H, of course. And so that was Macbeth was the – I can't remember exactly what it was. And it didn't seem to be one of the best plays I had read or put on stage by Ionesco because I did. I love Ionesco. But anyway, so but the funny thing is he is about – 5 feet 2 inches maybe. And she, his wife, Radhika, is about 5 feet and maybe 2 inches. They're both exactly the same size. And then they have this huge daughter who is about as tall as I am, which is almost 6 feet.
Yeah.
And so we went behind, Marshall and Corinne and I, Corinne was there, went behind them because we were guests of honor, and so we were following, you know, following the author type of thing.
Yeah.
And there was Marie-France, their daughter, holding mom on the right and dad on the left, and they looked like they're going to go on a circus.
Yeah, family trapeze.
And then the next thing you, because this I had been told, but I didn't believe it because, you know, why would I bother? Hello, you still there?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So then Ionesco is sitting. We're all in a you know, favorable row and whatnot. Ionesco is sitting to the right of me, next to a young guy who had been introduced, but I can't remember. And there is an intermission. The two seats are empty. Now this is the author, right? On the opening day, the two seats are empty. They rediscovered Ionesco, who had done at least 5 or 6 different bars with this young guy. Because Ionesco was known to try and escape his wife whenever he had a chance to get a drink.
Yeah.
And so he'd entice this young man having a conversation. Because also it was a good conversation. I wish I'd been the young man. I wasn't that young anyway. But I wish I'd been the guy next who he would take for a bar. I probably wouldn't have dared to leave, though. Marnie, my wife, was there as well. Corinne was there, and like everybody was there.
And what do you say? So, you're saying there are two empty seats. I don't know if I get what you mean.
They didn't come back.
Oh.
After intermission.
Ionesco and the girlfriend.
No, it was not a girl. It was a boy. But there's nothing gay about good old Ionesco.
Right, but he didn't come back.
Clearly, he wanted to have a company to go and bring to those bars. He never came back. Never came back at all. Hey, man, this is what happens at the end of an opening of a play. You just call the author, right?
Yeah.
No, it was very discreet. Nobody called the author at all. They knew the author was gone.
Did Marshall have anything to say about that?
Marshall actually couldn't care less. Marshall was not into personalities.
Right.
He was not into, you know, big celebrities either. Marshall arrived. I remember every detail of that time because I went twice in Europe with Marshall, and but I don't remember the other one very well. But this one I remember very well because it was full of events. One of them was Marshall coming there straight from the airplane, going to the apartment of Cartier-Bresson, the brother of the famous photographer who was the director of MAME, the edition that was publishing Marshall in French.
Yeah.
MAME, that was the name of the edition. And we are in that very, very, very elegant second-floor apartment with 4 windows onto the Seine, with little alcoves and places where you could do your writing. And so Marshall no sooner finds one of those, and he just lies down on the floor and falls asleep while people were walking all over his body holding drinks.
He laid down on the floor.
He laid down on the floor. He didn't see anything large enough. And he just thought, you know, so, you know, and I was terribly ashamed for him, but, you know, that's my French upbringing. But
how many people were in the room?
Oh, there were lots of celebrities.
Really?
At least 20 people, and I'm being on the conservative side. At least 20 people. And
that's
Corinne
a great
was
story.
Trying to make Corinne was always trying to screen these things, you know, act as like nothing had happened.
Yeah.
Sort of, well, you know, how can I attract it? I see her trying to divert the attention.
Well, did he sleep through the whole evening?
He didn't. He eventually did get up and he explained, brushing his clothes, that it was a perfectly fine thing to do after he had taken a plane, and that he needed those. He was like Napoleon, but he didn't say that. But he needed this kind of quick nap.
Yeah, power naps all day long. Yeah.
Power nap, and he was perfectly happy with it. And everybody was perfectly happy with it, too, so it was not a drama. And the next time we had a dinner, I think we might have spent almost a week. Anyway, the next time there was a dinner, and that dinner was huge. And the Minister of Culture, the Minister of Education came with his wife, and of course was seated at the center with McLuhan on his left, his wife on his right, Marshall with Corrine on her right, Corrine on his right, and then all the and me in the vulgum pecus, in the crowds, because there was a huge semicircular table of which the center was occupied by the aforementioned, and then there was a parterre of ranks of tables where so five, maybe not five, 400 people certainly. Imagine dinner for 400 people in the French, not restaurant. This was like, where was it? It was, I think it was somewhere in the university or something like that. Anyway, yeah, I think it was a university, one of the amphitheaters. They had taken one of the amphitheaters of the university, gotten rid of the chairs and put tables instead.
Yeah.
And so Marshall is tired, well, he's, you know, gets these bouts of tiredness, but he has this enormous cigar in his mouth. And his head is nodding, and Corrine is constantly sitting next to him, sort of, you know, you can see it, she's sort of, you know, elbowing him a little bit, saying, "Wake up, you turkey." You know. Marshall then walks up, raises his head again, pulls a long draw on his cigar, and falls immediately back to sleep. And this is the clou de la soirée. Not only does he fall asleep, but his head nods, and not so much with his cigar, that his cigar plunges right in the middle of his wine glass and goes.
Marx Brothers.
At which point he wakes up.
Wow,
so that was really, that was just a wonderful moment.
Well, while he was doing that, were people giving speeches or eating?
Yeah, of course they were giving speeches. Was the minister blabbing? What do you think?
Did anybody notice it besides you?
No, and I, evil person, was coming back from the because it was postprandial of to boot. So I was coming back from having had a washing my hands, so to say.
Yeah.
And I ran across the people who were doing the filming. And I said, "Did you see that?" And the kids, the people say, "Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is wonderful." I said, "I hope you're going to put it in." "Oh, no, we won't." I was very naive. I thought, "Oh, that would be very interesting to talk." But the minister's talking, give me a break. Yeah. No. I've always been extremely poor at politics. But
you had to just be good. This is the real Marshall. And they understood not to.
Yeah, no. Dave Goff. Yeah.
So, do you think many people saw Marshall doing that?
The people who were immediately, I saw it, and the guys who were with me saw it, and I knew them well. They were very sweet people too. We became friends after that. Marnie and I, and Francis and Marie Ball. They had split, which made me very sad. Francis and Marie. Francis Ball was a very close student of one of the mandarins of the university in communication. What was his name? Vieikaz or something like that. I'll have to remember his name. It'll come back. But anyway, yeah, he was a devoted student of that, and he introduced me. And had I played my cards, if I had known I even had cards, I would probably have been much more involved with the French cultural and the economic, not economic, but cultural world. But I have to say, you know, I've never really wanted much out of Paris, and so it was just as well. But it's true that Francis would have wanted me to join him in research, and what's his name? Cazeneuve. Jean-Marie Cazeneuve.
Cazeneuve, I've seen that name, yep.
Cazeneuve. Yeah, maybe not Jean-Marie. Jacques Cazeneuve? No, not Jacques. Okay,
what university? Is this the Sorbonne? What is it called?
That's the Sorbonne Center one. Sorbonne 1 or 2, but it's at the center of Paris.
Right.
Okay. And it's cool. It's a communication.
Well, as we talk about Ionesco, you translate it from Collegiate Archetype. It begins with the Ionesco play, The Bald Soprano.
Yes.
And McCloom points out that it ends with the character sniffing. I thought that was really good. Now, do you remember that? The osmic sense is emphasized at the end of the play, The Bald Soprano.
Yeah,
you saw that.
And what about her, The Bald Soprano?
Well, no, I'm saying the sniffing. And Marshall's pointing out at the end of the play.
No. Didn't you know the play?
No, I don't know. I've never seen it.
So the question is, what about the doll? And what? At one point in the play, it says, "What about the bald soprano?" And the answer is, she does her hair always the same way.
She doesn't what? Yes.
She does her hair always the same way.
Okay.
That was a profound response to a very deep question.
But the important thing is Marshall saying that the osmic sense is the most intimate sense, the most close to knowing or gnosis.
Yes.
That's what I thought that he was pointing out, the role of the nose.
The role of the nose.
Or the smell.
He was very fond of what's his face work on that, Hall, Ned Hall. Remember Ned?
Oh, I know, Edward Hall. No, it's
they
the other guy. The other guy did the nose. Remember, he was Herb. His name was the same name as a nose or smell or sense. Remember that guy, that other book? I mean, Hall did stuff, but there was a particular book that he would...
I didn't know that one.
Yeah, and it's in the Cultures of Business. I think it has a clothespin. The ad has a clothespin on the nose, but it's Edward Lear or somebody. Somebody like that who did a book. Anyways, there's another book besides Hall. But yes, Hall did the one that stands out for us is Hall's story of the Arab standing real close to you to smell you.
No,
right?
that was Hall's observation. He said even the measurement. He said if it's beyond 20 meters, they stop trusting you.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm quoting Hall, and I'm saying that's the famous one, the smell anecdote that he tells.
I heard that one retold to me by McLuhan himself, of course, in fact, more than once.
Right, yes.
Marshall was not afraid of repeating himself.
No, and he would often, phone up barrier people in the middle of the night and say he has a new discovery, and they'd heard it 5 years before, three times. Marshall forgot that he made these discoveries. He already made them.
And then he woke you up in the middle of the night.
He did that
to me. Yes, of course he did.
Did you ever get a call in the middle of the night?
Are you kidding? Is the Pope Catholic? Of course I got to. I was when I was doing the Cliché to Archetype translation, I think he woke me, but not just me, also Marnie, at least five times.
Wow.
In Port Hope. I was living in Port Hope. At least five times. Derek,
did he have a repeat discovery?
Of course he had repeat. There were always repeat discoveries.
Yeah.
No, there were sometimes interesting thoughts about how to put better a moment in Cliché to Archetype. He did, I think he really surprisingly paid a fair bit of attention to this translation.
Yeah.
And was much more collaborative. Personally collaborative in that than in anything else we've ever did together. He was very collaborative because he did wake you up in the middle of the night, but that meant he actually thought about it, was interested, and I heard him twice say to people who might have been interested that he preferred the French version, that he had done the work with me and he preferred the French version.
And it had some different points in it.
And it had different points
in
it, and I brought in the idea of, since we were talking about cliché, I thought the best the best thing to do was to bring the clichés of Bouvard and Pécuchet from Flaubert.
Yeah.
Flaubert said when he talked about why he wrote that book, he said, I wrote that book with fury, pouring all my anger at the ignominious idiocy of my contemporaries. That's no, he was really furious. He had all these people talking, and it's a documentary, a social documentary on the new class that's rising in France at the time, because he's describing a middle class which wants to play upper a little bit, but really is middle class of petit bourgeois who have so common and absolutely unchecked ideas that it drives him bananas.
Well, and Eric listed it as a Manippean satire.
It is a minute. It's a superb one. And then what he does at the end of the book is add something like 20 pages, man, that's a big load. Add 20 pages of all these cliches of his own time, which, of course, is a precious resource.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I said to Marshall, why don't we, since the book is already alphabetically ordered, the chapters have alphabetic kind of, start with the alphabetic letter sometimes. Why don't we put, since these clichés are done by Flaubert in alphabetical order, just insert our stuff in the middle of his much shorter definition so we won't make a mistake. It's really Flaubert on one side and it's McLuhan on the other. And actually, I think it's very nice. I think it was a nice idea. It's lots of fun. It brings back, it makes a point about the cliché and the archetype. I'm very pleased to think about it. It's the first time that the thought ever crossed my mind of imagining Marshall as collaborating with somebody else.
Yeah.
Marshall was collaborating with Marshall, and then somebody else might have been,
Yeah.
The way he was collaborating with Nevitt, as you know, wasn't that friendly. It was just, yeah, it was very
yeah,
different.
It was almost like Barry took advantage of making notes while Marshall was giving monologues.
Yeah, yeah.
And he made a book out of it, and Marshall said, oh, that's okay, put that out.
But he actually did a good job at doing, not simply synthesizing Marshall, but actually as if he was giving some flesh to some of the things Marshall came up with.
Yes, and bringing in a little more Finnegan's Wake and playing with
Yes
Tomorrow.
Yes, but with tremendous intelligence.
Maybe I should really look at that, the part that
you
was
know
left
what
out, the Ten
you know
Thunders
what,
of Finnegan's Wake, and, you know, managed by Prevision. That part was left out of the book. They go through the Ten Thunders of Finnegan's Wake and apply it to management. That's I'll have to look at what I have.
Yeah.
What are we going to say?
What I'm saying about Barry, this is an aside, but it's true. I mean, one of the things that Barry, why I didn't sort of click into Barry right off the bat.
Yeah.
Apart from the nasty remarks made by Marshall, which didn't help.
Yeah.
That's one thing for sure. and the fact that Barry had a tendency to mumble. He had his way of talking and ramble and mumble at the same time. You know, and that was like pretty irritating. But the worst thing, I think, and this is where it's coming through, there was something about the Holy McLuhan pray for us in his attitude.
The what?
That Holy McLuhan pray for us. There was something too much about that, and I didn't want that. I was the director of the program at the time, and I just wanted to make sure the people who were there were going to continue Marshall's work, but they were not going to,
memorize
repeat
Marshall.
It.
Yeah.
And what I now read in the various excellent quotes that you've brought here is that he wasn't just repeating McLuhan.
No.
He was actually truly expanding on it, and he was explaining things in his way, but very, very logically. Logically.
Yeah.
I like his description of the difference between the generalist and the comprehensivist. I like his way of describing
really
understanding.
The,
you know,
the generalist is just dealing with different disciplinary concepts. The comprehensivist is dealing with different modalities. That's really important.
It is really important. And he actually truly understood that and expressed it very well. When he talks about what understanding is, let me just find what.
Before you do that, I want to add this telephoning. There's a lot of Wyndham Lewis in Marshall. Did you know that Wyndham Lewis, every morning, at some point in his life in London, he would, every morning, he'd take out the phone book and randomly pick a number and call a person and harangue them. This was how he began every day.
Wyndham Lewis?
Yes, he would do that every morning. He'd get up, get the phone book out, whatever they had in London, get a number at random, and call, and whoever answered, get a Wyndham Lewis lecture.
How awful.
Yeah.
But as I say, what a great honor.
And also shows a guy not embedded in the technologies. He's not, you know, following the protocol where you have to answer the phone and be polite. He doesn't give a damn. He's using it as his latest art form.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. And so Marshall picked up a lot of stuff from Lewis. I'm thinking his disrespect for the decorum of when you call somebody was influenced by Lewis, you know? That Marshall would call whoever, whenever. He didn't care what the clock said.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. So back to what you were saying about Barry was the understanding. You're looking up understanding?
Yeah. It's actually very, it's a very simple description.
Are you looking? Shall I look too?
For understanding, here we go. I read it for you.
But what part?
For understanding, huh?
What part is it? Okay, just read it, but is it near the pre-play?
No, it's quite below it. It's
actually
the third sort of large paragraph after it, or fourth, in fact. No, it's the third, the third.
Okay.
So, for understanding is the simultaneous grasp of the conflicting facets of any situation in its changing figure-ground relationships. I mean, I can hear him say this.
Yes.
And then hearing say this, I don't want to understand, but when I read it, I do want to understand. I find it very interesting. That reveal both their complementary aspects and their dominant process patterns. Understanding demands comprehensive awareness that uses all wits and senses with ESP. Although even that formulation, the last line, is naive, it actually drives the point because it's very difficult to precisely describe what it is that brings us the maximum of understanding in any situation.
Let me read it slowly. I say that Nevitt demonstrates his awareness of the comprehensivist role as having a tactile feature when he constantly highlights the biases of visual and acoustic spaces and collapses them into a statement such as this, and this is what you read. For understanding is the simultaneous grasp of the conflicting facets of any situation in its changing figure-ground relationships. See, that's a lot more complex than what Marshall would say, understanding is not a point of view.
Yeah.
This is a little more, and it's his excess talking, that reveal both their complementary aspects and their dominant process patterns. Understanding demands comprehensive awareness that uses all wits and senses with ESP. Now, it's good he throws in ESP, but you're saying that's naivety?
No. No. It's not cognitive science. But it is a good communication of what understanding is about. And it's understanding at something. Now, Marshall used to say understanding was, you try to go to the meaning of understanding under, that is actually seeing the whole thing.
Standing under, right.
Standing under. So it never helped me, but Marshall didn't repeat that.
Well, what's amazing is that, Marshall says understanding is not a point of view, so people might think, oh, I just don't have a point of view, I'll listen to anything and maybe be anarchistic
in my points
of view. No, it's way closer to what Barry's saying. And Barry's the only one who spells, he translates Marshall in details. It's wordy, but it's worth the time to figure out what he's saying.
Well, the funny thing is that there is a Trance McLuhan via the Kirchhoff disciple who has written about this, who is he's part of the book we're publishing right now, the book on touch, when he talks about the intelligence of space, the intelligence of space being space and whatever is outside the body has intelligence like the body.
Right. Now, this you say this is a disciple of de Kirchhoff? Is that what you just said?
Well, it's a disciple of McLuhan via de Kirchhoff.
Oh, okay.
That's what it is.
Right.
Nino is called Gaetano Mirabella. He's a professor of philosophy, retired now from the University of Salerno in Italy. And he wrote a book, Il Sapere Sentiente, the Feeling Knowledge. And it's very interesting because it's very different, for example, than I've always liked that writer, but it's a bit of a popular book. It's quite different with Mirabella. The guy who wrote about Eugene Gendlin, you know Gendlin? Eugene Gendlin?
He
wrote about touch. No, he's probably one of the better books that I've read. That and Luceron's better books that I read on touch.
Right, Luceron.
Luceron was a big influence on Marshall about touch.
Yeah.
And
so what this thing about something, the intelligence is outside of the body? Is that what you're saying?
No. The intelligence is inside and outside. In other words, there is intelligence in the comprehensive state of things. There is intelligence, as opposed to simply being in the mind of an individual.
Okay, so the figure ground or the you and the environment, intelligence is neither in one side or the other.
That's right.
The
it's
interplay.
In both places. Yeah.
Well, that's good.
It's so yes, it is. I think it is interesting. He expresses himself not very well. He's a terrible academic in terms that I can't. You know, footnotes are nowhere to be seen. But I don't really care about that. He actually adds to the book. He brings a facet to the book which is very interesting. And I think it is comprehensivist. I think it really is. And I will tell him. I'll send him this thing. I'll tell
right.
him to read it.
Have
although
you...
he's lazy as hell. But he may read the title.
Right.
He's terrified of English. Like
I'm getting this idea in that famous Catholic Humanism in Modern Letters, 1954. It's a very good article. Marshall talks about one cannot know anything outside you unless it's an extension of you. He talks about, you know, the basic sensory interaction with the environment. And your intelligence, whatever, knows the outer environment, else it wouldn't have translated it, and through the eye it slips the image and that kind of stuff. That is an intimacy between the outside world and you, which is a deeper way of understanding the world as an extension of you, or me as an extension. Your friend is describing the tactile interplay of an extension, because it is you, even though it appears it isn't you.
Yeah, no, and another writer in the book... completes that observation and has become very famous. She's an architect from Rio de Janeiro. She has written a book called The City Is Me. And she goes through every definition of identity, self, selfhood, other, all that, of the, you know, long, very nice, very beautifully studied a series of them, and then says, you know, when you think about it, whatever it is that you are surrounded by, whatever concept that you are throwing to actually make sense of the space you're in, is part of you, and that's what it is. So the city is me.
Right, but here's what I add. I bet you they don't bring in. It's the fact that writing and then visual space comes in, makes that separation, and then you have a tactile realization of how they're involved. But pre-literate people, pre-writing, have animism. They don't have this tactile thing. They're inside it, and they can't tell, and it's not an issue. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, no, no, for sure. I mean, and it's also, you remember the famous story of Michael Smart. He's the one that...
Yeah, wigwam is lost. No, no, you're not.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That's the world traverses the body. The body is the interface of a world that goes through it, but it's not going into the world or walking like the stage of Shakespeare.
No.
That's the difference, you see.
Yeah.
Spatially, it's a completely different kind of spatial relationship.
That's
but
right.
Anyway, we can go ahead. We'll go on with this.
Well,
I just wanted
to
get back to the cause and effect.
Michael Smart, he's out. He's with the natives in Canada, and they get lost. He says, "We're lost." And they say, "No, we're not lost. Wigwam is lost."
Yeah.
So that was
a
big epiphany for him.
He loved it.
Yeah.
He
so
loved
back...
it, and we all did. And I've told that story many times because when you want to say, look, man, the space that you live in is not natural space. It's your space. But here's another one for you.
But the thing is to bring in the sensory causes that make you think space is one way or another. That's the important part. That's the hidden ground of the process. So I'm saying the city is me. Did she bring in sensory biases? No, she didn't. I'm predicting she does not bring that in. The city is me when you live under electric conditions.
Yeah. No, for sure. No, she does bring in McLuhan, and she does bring electric conditions, for sure.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, she does. But I don't know that she actually focuses on the senses, so that when the thing was to do with touch, she was very interested in applying one aspect of her work that related to it very well. And so we have a whole chapter by her, which is just beautiful. It's called Urbanism.
Urbanism.
Why
is that OR or ALB?
OR, OR.
Urban, yeah, Urban Orbs. That's from Finnegan's Wake.
Well, there you are. She,
yeah.
I don't know where she was quoting good old Finnegan, but I know that she certainly used that word and
Urbanism.
Probably thought she created it.
Nice. Okay, now you wanted to go back to prospect or effects and causes?
Yes, I'm going to do that. But I have a parched throat, so I'm going to get myself something to drink.
Yeah.
And I'll
do instant pre-play. Let's do the. Well, you go get your drink. I'm going to read Tetrad instant pre-play. And that's what Barry's trying to do. This book is called ABC of Prophecy, and he's trying to give you a pre-play of what's coming. And he says it's pretty simple to do once you understand McLuhan's methodology. So the instant replay extends, or Barry says expands, perceptual process patterns of present ground into the future. Now, for anybody who has a copy of Take Today, go to page 137 and read the bottom five lines. That's the crux of the book where Barry talks about the differences between cause and effect and has italicized parts of the sentences, and that's where he's talking about perceptual process patterns. It's an aside if you want to see how Barry does an extreme version of this in Take Today. So it extends perceptual process patterns of present ground into the future. It contracts ground or obsolesces ground for conceptual ground rules of past sequentiality when causes logically preceded effects. It retrieves non-visual environment of simultaneity where effects merge with causes ecologically. Now, there's a further sentence that Barry makes that's on page 137 of Take Today at the bottom, and I don't see him getting into it in the fourth law. He says, flips present into future as all times and places now here capitalized, and effects precede causes by design. See, that's the later stage, by design.
Yeah.
Effects precede causes natural in a pre-literate society that doesn't even have the distinction between effects and causes. Mm-hmm. Literacy makes the distinction of effects and causes, and then it's all bottled up in that for 2,500 years. Then the electric environment brings back
effects precede causes. But then the satellite global theater comes in, and then you program the society for programmed ESP, effects precede causes. That's the complexity Barry's trying to explain that Marshall got to, and nobody talks about. You know when they say Marshall, famous for the global village and the medium's message, they should say, oh, he took Wyndham Lewis's idea of the global village and the medium's message, and he applied it and complexified it, and he came up with the answer of where original sin came from. This is what Marshall discovered, why we were numb to what was happening. That was what he discovered. That's never said. Well, why should we? Why should anybody know that? But that's the important thing. He explained why people thought when television came in that there was a global village. They were numbed, and the sensory races changed. That's what he says in Understanding Media.
Right. No. And he says that our extensions actually numb us to what
yes.
they're extending.
And that for him, that he used to say, original sin was the. Lack of interest in what was going on around you or with your awareness and with your processing and your senses. That's where the original sin is. And he wondered why humans had original sin. And he thought he had eureka, Archimedes-like. I had figured it out, he said. It is due to the numbing process and our sensory ratios and the shifting of them. That was his big discovery. And Michael Bliss didn't know that, did he?
No. But I would love to know whether the original sin was, in fact, actually a specialization of the senses. Like, you know, here's the devil disguised as a snake that is talking to these people and bringing their attention to this issue of control and power.
Yeah.
So that's what they specialize. That's where instead of a measured relationship of dialogue with the environment, they want to control it. Paradise is a place where everybody, I've been there, so I can tell you. Everybody.
Oh, and I live there. I'm living in paradise.
You live in paradise. Well, man, I'm pretty close, too. I can show it to you. It's pretty nice from here as well.
Okay.
But anyway, it's not just here, too, other places. Paradise, as I said, but I'm talking about the real one. So
yeah.
Paradise is the place where everybody, every soul, every person, we assume remains a person, is in a dialogue, in harmony with nature, harmony. It's like the terrestrial paradise that was given to Adam and Eve is basically the idea of a perfect union with nature. And so suddenly, the specialization, the perfect union is comprehensive, of course, has to be.
Yeah.
But suddenly, there is a temptation of grabbing a one thing only, the mechanics behind
time.
It, power,
yeah.
One thing at a time, as opposed, and suddenly the comprehensive perception is lost,
yes.
Completely lost. So what I find interesting in the questions that are raised by this idea of causes and effect, we are condemned to a destiny-shaped
We were numb by the causes and effects.
Yeah, completely. We were numb by writing.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I
told you that I've always found very interesting that narratives, the storifying, storyline, begins with literacy when the Greeks invent the three goddesses of death, of life and death. The first one is the one who spins the yarn of your destiny, which is a yarn, it's a line. People have already seen our destiny as a single line.
Yes.
And her name is Clotho. Clotho is cloth, actually it's written like T-H-O.
Yeah.
She pulls the cloth, and Lachesis is her sister, and takes the cloth in her hand and measures it. She actually measures it. She actually says, now this is as much as this person is going to live. And Atropos, the third sister, has scissors in her hand and cuts the thread.
Hmm.
That's an incredible.
And what that comes in with literacy, you're saying?
Of course it does. It's actually a rather late in the story, whatever people know about the goddess story and their reports, Theodosia, another thing of Theodicea, we don't know. But I don't know all of it in detail, but I've always found that amazing that suddenly death was divided into three processes.
Right.
and okay. all attached to it.
That's like the Logos being divided into the
that's
Trivium.
Right. That's what I'm saying. And this yeah. is what's so interesting about you when you go back to pick the old myths and try and make sense of them in terms of what's going on in your own time. It's absolutely fantastic.
And McLuhan and Barry spells this out, felt that the gods, those mythology, were about new technologies.
Yes, yes.
So that, you know, Zeus was a technology, or Ariadne was a technology, or any of the gods, they were the introduction of a new technology. And it upset
yes.
the balance among the gods, and they'd have all their conflicts because of it, right?
The gods by the Greeks were invented very late in the game, even after the arrival of literacy. And one of the most interesting god, late god, to be invented was Eros.
Mm.
And the reason given to that was the reason I give to that, and I don't know that anybody ever even I didn't follow that closely enough to be able to pretend that I actually invented this idea. But
yeah.
here's what I think about it: literacy brings the revolution of the senses. The relationship between self and other changes because of, you know, the separation that the body suddenly feel very strongly, the individuality of each person
yeah.
very strong and becomes more and more desirable. And Eros is the god invented to appease love.
No,
that's his job.
That's what Marshall says. For a literate man, sex is very heady. It is not
yes.
heady for preliterate people. So you're beginning to have sex or the tactile involvement of sex being isolated as an art form as called Eros, as a balance
well,
to the new visual bias. That's what you're
well,
explaining.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I think it has to do with yielding a self. Suddenly I have a self. Am I going to give that self or am I going to grab that self? Pain of love,
yeah.
of unrequited love, pain of...
You're talking about emotional love, not sexual love.
Emotional, but the desire to everything. It's
yeah.
very strongly sexual, too.
Okay.
It's very strongly sexual.
Right.
No, I think the Greeks developed a tremendous problematics with their own bodies, just as around the time of Freud, we actually reversed the process.
Yeah.
Freud is somebody who just says, well, you know, you don't really have to worry about that.
Right. but it's important to realize this is the service of visual space. It starts to create individual one-on-one connection you're calling
yeah.
love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then that's retrieved after the Dark Ages in the troubadours.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I had a point there. Oh, what about Eris, E-R-I-S, who throws the apple into the meeting of the gods and causes chaos? When does she come in? You know, causes confusion.
Eris is the god of war.
Yeah, and discord, I think. Or maybe that's
and
war.
And discord. Now,
yeah.
I thought it was Paris who did the job, not Eris.
Well, I've heard it's E-R-I-S, according to the Discordians. The Discordians emphasize E-R-I-S. Maybe
that actually threw the apple?
Yeah,
the apple.
She threw the apple into the middle of the meeting of the gods, and they all started fighting over it, and she's laughing at the chaos she's caused. She caused discord.
That's a different story completely. No, I thought you were talking about the judgment of Paris, which
gives
the golden apple to the to Jude or to Venus, of course.
No, this is discord. So I was wondering how if that's even connected to Eros or Eris. Anyways, it's not that important. Somebody could check it out someday. I want to say this when talking about power. One time in a Monday night seminar after, I was talking to Marshall, and another guy comes up and they get talking. And Marshall says, you know, we spent a whole year analyzing what power is, and we couldn't figure out. We decided there wasn't any.
Isn't that good? That's good.
Yeah, and he would say that. We spent a whole year discussing what is wealth. You know, and I don't know if anybody knew they were discussing that. I don't know if Marshall ever announced it. It might have been in the classrooms, you know, his actual courses. But he certainly didn't do that on the Monday nights. Okay, so you have the kinetic manipulatory, the American as the cop of the world in the 20th century, and Marshall calls that kinetic manipulatory bias. You're talking about the beginning of power as visual space, visual bureaucracy with writing.
Yeah.
Is that what you were trying to say?
Well, regarding cause and effect, I was really onto the problem of cause. No, the story of power is just a matter of one amusing explanation of original sin. I mean, you started me on that.
Right.
I'm not saying that I have the answer to that question, but I think it was interesting to think in terms of what Hal Marshall or Barry or anybody, if just kind of took on to school of communication, would approach the problem by saying, what kind of sensory bias does it push? What kind of involvement does it, is the snake high definition or low definition?
Yeah, that's a good one. How about the emperor? He doesn't lead. He puts on the audience, but it is an image of iconicity or power. And they don't have that in the Aboriginal societies. They rotate whoever's good at fishing or hunting or this or that rules for the 2 hours they're doing it. Do you know what I mean? They just rotate, which is the way we live today. I think that's the way people live in modern technological society. They live like that. Everybody rolls around, and that's why you have all these different departments in the corporation. One guy does this, and he's the expert on that, and the other guy does that, and the new problem was that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. But the thing is, the rotating of power is the passing the buck today.
Okay, so instant preplay. Let's go back to the tetrad side of it. Expand perceptual process patterns of present ground into the future. That I'm not saying it's bad.
Okay,
but
you don't have a copy of Take Today there, do you?
No.
All right. While you were doing something, I was talking, I was telling everybody to go to 137 at some point. Page 137, I'll try to, at the bottom, try to say what he says. He has causes in quotes, and causes, let's see, effects precede causes. No, I'm not going to say it. I'm going to go get it and read it properly. So go ahead while I go get it. I'll be listening and talking while you begin at the beginning, because it's what he's saying here is spelled out on page 137. It's very important what he italicizes.
Well, I will just give my explanation of what I read into this tetrad.
Good. Go ahead.
So instant preplay is a... expands perceptual process patterns of present ground into the future. I think that that particular expansion, the idea of, it's a good idea. It's a good idea. I don't think it's the most interesting one of them all, but it's one that actually sets the whole stage.
Yes.
Contracts ground for conceptual ground rules of past sequentiality. That is clear. It's actually very interesting because it actually shows that there are. You can read that past. You can actually throw these sequence. You can see them. When causes logically preceded effects. True. That's causality comes in with literacy, and it's quite evident with both tragedy or history, which come at the same time.
Causes and effects as two separate phenomena come in with literacy. They split. The tactile interplay we were talking about, where the world is extended.
They split. You're right. That's actually what it is. They do split. And so that's a very important, I would say it's much more interesting, that second line, than the first one. Because it actually does then set you in the right kind of comprehensive pattern of mind to think about these terms of causes and effects. I mean, in quantum mechanics, obviously causes and effects are simultaneous.
Yeah, that's getting to the city is me, tactile, retrieval of tactile awareness.
All that stuff, all that stuff.
That we were
saying
earlier.
Then the next line, retrieve non-visual environment of simultaneity where effects merge with causes ecologically. That's a lovely thought. It's very interesting. And it actually, I like the word ecological thrown in there because that's exactly what that's our predicament in terms of the planet as, our survival on the planet. That's what it is.
And he's saying that ecology involves the senses, not some abstract thing of getting rid of pollution.
And it's not and non-visual. That's the retrieve of the non-visual environment. It's also very good. It really is. It's a great tetrad. I mean, it really is good. And I probably will use it as I use the Decalogue, because I think both of them are terribly useful to explain certain things.
Yes,
And I do like flip present into future, as all times, places, now, here, and effects precede causes by design. So,
can you see someone reading that? You got to take a lot of time to understand a few things about McLuhan, even to understand that sentence.
Yeah. No, it's true. And this is one of the things that probably turned people off Barry, because Barry makes it more difficult rather than simpler. You actually have to be trained to read Barry, you know.
Yes, that's right.
So maybe that's what the problem was. Because he deserves much more attention than he's gotten.
Well,
much
good.
More.
You're the first person to acknowledge the purpose achievement of the first part of this essay, is that it retrieves Barry, which was my intention.
It does.
Yes.
It's a very good job. It's a very good job, and it brings out some very exciting. By the way, somebody who likes you is good old Michael Edmonds, who was here yesterday. I had a brunch. I threw a brunch party for some of my friends, and Michael is one of them. And so he said, I said, I'm being interviewed now sometime with Bob. And he said, I like Bob.
I didn't know. Michael and I've stayed at his place, through the naughty knots and that. When I used to go to Toronto, Mike and I have done a lot. Mike has a lot of stuff to contribute. He does have a good collection of memories and had very good involved with George Thompson, and
you'd be very happy to know that he liberally distributed to anybody who might be interested an off-print of the varsity bits of the exploration, and it was by Thiel. I can go.
He handed out the party.
Yeah,
that might have been the one that I put out, or maybe something else. An off-print of something by Thiel. Oh, the one on Phineas Wake?
I think so.
Yeah, here comes everybody.
It's not on my hand right now. I was so busy. If you're by yourself, and you have to give a party for 18 people, believe me, it's not that easy.
Yeah.
So I had to be all the time inside, and I just looked past at it, thanked him profusely.
Well, you know, that article is really important. That was comes out in Explorations 2 or 3 or 4, early. Don Thiel is 54. He's just finishing his PhD. He's 25 or so years old. And so he writes that, and Gideon's wife, Carol Gideon Welker, or Carol Welker Gideon, do you know that name, Siegfried Gideon's wife? She reads it, because Gideon was part of Marshall's network, and she writes a note to Don and McLuhan saying that Don hits the best explanation, he expresses the best explanation of Finney's way she's ever seen, and they were so involved with Joyce, they were who he went to Switzerland with when he left France in 1940, and they're the ones who buried him. So here are the closest friends of Joyce at the end of his life, and she's saying that Don Thiel's article that Michael's handing out is the best article she'd ever seen of Finney's Wake up to that point. It's a really important article in Joyceana.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting.
Yeah, if it's called Here Comes Everybody, that's the article. But you're saying that it's an off-print of a Thiel article, then it has to be that if it's on if it was in Explorations or unless it was in the Varsity Graduate. But anyways,
I'm going to read it tonight.
Yes. Okay, so here is page 137, and it's a section called From One Sense, that's hyphenated, capital letters, to Con Sense, hyphenated. From One Sense to Con Sense. Then he has a folk saying, seeing is believing, but feeling is God's own truth. And then it goes into the cybernetics group, the IEEE newsletter, and has some complicated quotes from there. And then in a paragraph below, it says, nature loves vacuums and plays the field, while classifiers fill the spaces and spoil the sport. Okay, so he has that in italics. Then he says, all paradigms are traps. Any philosophy that considers sensations and concepts as mere reflections, in quotes, or copies, in quotes, of material objects in the human mind fails to account for the continual transformation of sensory inputs, that's your process pattern recognition, continual transformation of sensory inputs into outputs of quite different kinds. Food for the mind is like food for the body. The inputs are never the same as the outputs.
I found that later somewhere else.
Yeah. That's right. This pattern of nonlineality is evident. So nonlineality involves the proprioceptive digestive system. You know, it's not just, that looks chaotic. It's not a visual sense. The process of consumption of the food and how the inputs are changed and different from the outputs, that's part of the nonlineality. It's involving other senses, not just the visual version of nonlineality. You see what I'm saying? Pattern of nonlineality is evident in every human activity. I'll do that again. This pattern of nonlineality is evident in every human activity. Now, here comes the important part, at the bottom of page 137. And this is capitalized letters. As figures, and he has that in quotes, all senses create their own spaces, which are metamorphosed by interaction with their environmental grounds. And grounds is in quotations. Then he says this, causes in quotations become effects in quotations via concepts. And via concepts is italicized. So he's talking about the split, causes become effects via concepts, which means deliberate effect. They've split the causes. There's an interplay between causes and effects. So they, one becomes the other, this and that, via concepts. Whereas effects merge with causes, and in this part, effects and causes are not italicized and don't have quotes around them. Whereas effects merge with causes in process pattern recognition via percepts, and via percepts is not italicized. So you have to look at how carefully this sentence is written, the positioning of the quotation marks, the positioning of the italicized.
You don't have that in digital form, do you? No, of course not.
No, I can type it up.
Hang in there. Let me see if I've got the book. I said I didn't, but I mean, there are so many things, and of course, everything is completely not ordered.
Are you at your cottage or at your home?
I'm at the cottage. I only have a cottage now. I don't have no home.
Oh, okay.
What I have here, what is this? Oh, it's Tom Wolfe, the Bump House Gang. It's not anywhere close to what I thought it was.
Yeah, you're fully aware of how Tom Wolfe would write these books in the 70s inspired by something McLuhan said. All his books are takeoffs on McLuhan. You know that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that. I mean, I assume it could be the case.
Well, that one, The Painted Word, that he begins quoting McLuhan and reading the newspapers like Taking a Bath, and then he develops conceptually McLuhan's figure ground ideas about the history of art without quoting McLuhan, but making fun of the conceptualizers, the theorists, and say they're more important than the painters because it's a literate society. You know, The Painted Word. The theory is more important than the painting. But that's exactly an anthropological / media ground study that McLuhan would come up with.
No, because I'm looking for it because I have two copies of Take Today, one way of which I used to write notes on to see how I could adapt it to for the French.
When I was with Tim Leary in 1993, and we did a TV show, Nelson and I and Tim Leary. We filmed it at his home, taped it at his home, and in his home he had a copy of Take Today signed by Corinne. It was given to Tim after Marshall passed on, so that's a little thing that he did have that book. I don't know if he read it, but that's a pretty rare McLuhan book.
Tim was very sweet. He was a very nice man. I had several meetings with him, and I was interviewed when he died for him.
You were interviewed like you were for McLuhan.
I had three calls with people asking me what I thought about Timothy Leary and what, you know. And so I did answer those. But I remember the one time that I went to his house, I went with Joichi Ito. Joichi Ito is today's replacement for Negroponte as the director of the Media Lab.
Yes.
At MIT.
I remember you had Negroponte in 1983 or 84 at your class there.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so Negroponte one day gave a call to Joy, who's a friend of mine and actually quite a close one, and he said, would you like to become director of the Media Lab? And Joy said, oh. Joy had no idea.
Wow.
But he accepted that because this is a fascinating job, anyways.
Who is Joy Ito?
Joy Ito is the director. He's an American Japanese, or Japanese American. I think his mother is Japanese born, or he and his both parents are Japanese born, but he was born himself in the United States, took a United States American citizenship, but he also goes back to Japan and lives half his life in Japan and the other half in the United States.
Is he still head of the Media Lab, or that's a while
ago? He is. No. He is. He's absolutely. He's been the head of the Media Lab for the last 3 or 4 years, and he is definitely the head of Media
Lab. So he went to Leary's house with you?
Yes, he said, Tim and I are old friends, which that was the case. I had known Tim at the McLuhan program. I'd invited Tim twice to come and talk and see us. But
And you also did the satellite broadcast. I think I actually saw that.
Yeah, we have that, too. So.
Yeah.
So we go to Tim's place. Tim was not well, and it was clear that he wasn't there for long, and he had actually made all the arrangements to actually put his papers in order, and he was terribly proud of it. And he was doing that with a guy called Jas Morgan.
Yes, I know. I know him.
You know Jas. Yeah. Jas was involved with the
Mondo 2000.
Mondo 2000 and Prince
Queen
Princess,
Mew.
What's what?
Queen Mew.
Queen Mew. I love Queen Mew. Queen Mew. The best statement by Queen Mew was, "If any one of you remembers the 60s, you couldn't possibly have been there."
That's right. Yeah. I didn't know she came up with that first. That's really
well. That was quoted in one other thing. Anyway, Jas was a very nice man. I met him there as well, and Jas had worked like you would. To put Leary's papers in order.
Yeah.
And so we go, and Leary was like, red proud of it, was so pleased. So he said, "Look, I'm going to show you what we've done with Jas, and come and see this." And so he brought us over to a garage kind of thing, and then, or a shed.
Yeah.
And there is a very nice order, geometrically placed, of large cardboard boxes, all very neat. And each one contains, of course, papers and books and whatever it is that was important to the life of Tim. And then Tim opens a big one, the top one, and he says, "Look at this." And he puts to us, he shows us the answer of the lab in Switzerland that had refused to examine with him or accept his request to come and do the study of LSD.
I know about that, the lab. Are you saying this was the results the lab came up
with? That was the lab. That was the response of the it was the letter refusing his help or his suggestions, a proposal of a project to study the LSD at that lab.
You know about 10 years later, some lab in Switzerland, might have been that one, finally accepted the study of LSD. So you're talking 93, 94, because he dies about 95, 96, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And so the lab originally objected.
It was 6 months before his death, so we can actually date that.
Right.
That I remember very well, because then I was in Italy and I was called and I talked about it. I thought he was a terribly nice man, really, really nice person. I had this is very funny. I don't know whether it should be recorded or not, but it is a story that is worth telling. I was in Venice with Tim Leary. I first met him in Ars Electronica, one of my first invitation to Ars Electronica in Linz, and then I think 3 months or 2 months later he was in Venice. A conference organized by Maria Grazia Mattei.
Yeah.
And so we're all sitting outside and having a wonderful dinner, but outside the building of the restaurant, and because in Venice, and there was room for that, and tables were all set outside, and it's a long, long table, and I'm not too far from his wife.
Leary's wife?
Leary's wife, yes.
Which was it, like the third or fourth one after
Rosemary? Well, Barbara Lee.
Yes, who then was later accused of being CIA. Did you hear about that?
The life between those two was not
ecological.
It was not a breeze. Absolutely not.
It was Eris rather than Eros.
So I'm in front of her, and she is a strikingly beautiful woman, but she's wearing these dark glasses. And just to make conversation, not in any intention of doing some seduction scene, I say, why do you always, like, it's at night now, and do you have a problem with your eyes? Why do you have to wear dark glasses? And she answers to me, tipping her glasses slightly to the right, but not enough to really see the whole eye. She says, "He who sees the eyes must see the rest."
Mm.
Very seductive. I'm told that absolutely the whole personnel of the famous hotel where those two were being housed, they were at the Gritti or Danieli or one of the two most famous hotels and most expensive hotels of Venice. Some wag said that they thought the whole personnel of the hotel had gone to bed with her.
Wow.
Because she was insatiable. So then I changed my spot and I go to Tim, because I was close enough to Tim to simply, I could just bring, really engaging conversation with him. And I liked him. He was a very nice person to talk to. So I sit next to him And then I say, "What? I just been talking to your wife, Barbara. She sounds very charming." She sort of looks at me, quickly hiding his dope. He was smoking dope also at the same time, and hiding his cigarette under the table as he had to. It was really very funny. He says, "Oh yeah." So I said, "Well, what does she do?" Oh well, nothing. Oh, that must be wonderful. Oh, no, he said, not at all. It's a full-time job to be Barbara Leary.
That's good.
Now, so they were not getting along that well at that time.
Right. Now, the you're putting the sunglasses on, you know, the icon of Andy Warhol comes in with at least black
TV.
Yeah,
I think there was a bit of that. There was a bit of that.
And color TV. So there you have... Visual biased Americans want to protect their something about the eyes. They want to hide the eyes. And is it a visually biased society that says the soul is the window, the eyes are your window to your soul? So here's this protection.
Yeah. It wasn't quite what she had in mind, but
no. But okay, I'm just developing. She's saying that the root to all of her is through her eyes, and she's protecting that, keeping that precious. Is that a visually biased person reacting to tactility, or is that a tactile person who is at the point of Greek mythology developing eros? See, I'm analyzing this in McLuhan's Figure Ground as I hear the anecdote.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's all I have to report, but it was a fun moment.
Okay, that's good. So yeah. you can't find your take today, so did you get
no.
what? I'll do it again. Causes in quotes become effects in quotes via concepts. So there is the split between causes and effects via concepts, and it's a figure ground process, so via concepts has to be italicized. It means via visual space, via literacy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's not going to italicize via percepts in the second part. He just says effects merge with causes in process pattern recognition via percepts. You can't tell the difference between the effect and cause.
That's right.
If you're in a world of percept, not concept, which is electric age, so then go back to this instant preplay. Expands perceptual process patterns of present ground into the future. So it's always going to be the present ground extended into the future, which is a cliche about science fiction. It's just describing the present. But it also echoes the now here, because the present is made up of everything, all times and places now here. So the present ground is huge. And then contracts ground for conceptual ground rules of past sequentiality when causes logically preceded effects. So that's the sequentiality, the literate effect, creates a split between causes and effects, and causes come before effects precede. So the electric environment, the program theater obsolesces that, right? That's gone.
Yeah.
The ground, there's no ground for causing the split. Then retrieves non-visual environment simultaneity where effects merge with causes ecologically. That's what he was saying on page 137. Then flips present into future. Now, this would be a different process than flipping the present ground in the future, right? There has to be something different here. It's the opposite. It's actually not doing that. It flips present into future as all times and places now here, and effects precede causes by design. So you flip out of the third phase, the retrieving where effects merge with causes, and then you move into where you actually make the separation again between effects and causes. I call that the tactile eye. But this time, effects are ahead of causes rather than causes.
Well,
so,
that was my question. Having reunited them, why divide them again?
Because it's the opposite of the beginning. The instant preplay flips into a disservice. It becomes the opposite situation. But wouldn't preplay think that there is a difference between the past, present, future, or that there's a difference between the effects and causes? So you have to include that. So maybe the instant preplay is not stage four. That's the disservice of overuse of preplaying.
Yes. Yeah.
Too much ESP. And remember, Take Today, Marshall says, it's a really important statement. This is 144. He says that visionary awareness, ESP, psychic stuff, mediumship, is not adequate to understanding the programming of the global environment.
it doesn't work anymore, any of the Aquarian conspiracies, fantasies. Do you know what I mean? That psychic awareness, visionary awareness by the chemical body doesn't work. And this is what Barry's trying to explain. And it is such new ground that anybody can do it if you understand it.
No, it's cool. Listen, man, I'm afraid now I'm going to have to take my leave. Tomorrow is no good because I'm going back to Italy.
Okay.
But we can do it again when I settle there a little bit. It's not going to be easy to do it for the next 5 days because I've got to give a couple of talks or run exams and do all kinds of silly things. But maybe around July 5th or 6th would be fine.
Okay, that'll be the weekend.
Yeah, and we can also do it by Skype if you prefer. I don't care. I mean, I have internet everywhere I go in Europe. So
okay, maybe we'll do that. And it would be a different phone number?
Oh, yeah. This is
okay.
This is Canada. The number...
No, don't say it. We'll email it.
All right. Okay.
All right. So I'll end by saying on page 148, it says, at electric information speeds, art and science and nature converge through understanding media. That's a really amazing statement. Art, science, and nature converge through understanding media. At electric information, only at electric information speeds.
Yes, of course.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Derek.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
This is fun. Ciao, ciao.